Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme.
That's what's so important about rooting people in places, is just having that reference to the past while also thinking about a really great way to move forward together in an urban environment.
Every country and every city is tasked with protecting its historic environment. But how do you do this properly and in a way that preserves these sites, also keeping them accessible to the public? We hear the case of the UK as we continue with part two of our series on heritage. Also ahead.
Greece is not about its monuments, it's about its people. And if there are no people to see and interact with monuments, there are no monuments.
We're in Greece to find out more about the role of archaeologists in protecting that nation's cities. And we visit one of the world's oldest tile factories, which is responsible for much of one city's trademark heritage. All this coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. And we start today's episode in Greece. This is a nation torn between the pull of its ancient past and the much-needed investments it must attract to move forward. The gatekeepers of this ancient cultural heritage are many, but none is as powerful as CAS, the state-run Central Archaeological Council. Both revered and reproached by architects and urban planners, the council has come to hold something of a mythical status. Monocle's Athens correspondent, Daphne Karnesis, recently spoke to the archaeologist Nikos Papadimitriou to find out about the role of archaeologists in shaping the city.
The role of archaeologists is, A, to protect, to discover and protect relics that belong to humanity, that belongs to everybody and should be preserved for the future generation. And second, to integrate this into the new urban landscape. Now, for this, there are quite a few policies, and these policies are not something which is specifically Greek. There are big conventions and agreements, international agreements, like the Valletta Chart of the International Council of Monuments and Sites, which describes precisely how archaeology should be treated by a legal framework and how this could coexist with what we call sustainable development in cities.
And can you give us, on a more practical level, some examples of how the archaeologists would work with, as you say, architects and urban planners?
There are certain councils that these things happen, which belong to the whole public sector. Okay, so these, first of all, the archaeological units, they consist themselves by a variety of specialists, not only archaeologists. So there are architects, there are urban planners, etc. And according to these international agreements that we mentioned earlier, and the main one is the agreement of Valletta in Malta in 1992, urban planning in such kind of cities should include also people from the heritage sector, including archaeologists. Now, the problem is that this doesn't happen always. And here is where conflicts arise. Before any development takes place, first of all, there must have been some planning that takes into consideration that you may have remains and how these remains are treated in future. The ideal is for these remains to be preserved in situ, in their place, if it is possible, without compromising the development, but also without compromising the ability of future people to be familiar, to have access to that.
Thinking about the Thessaloniki metro station, where again some artifacts were discovered, and one of the considerations, one of the scenarios was actually keeping the discoveries in situ for the public to be able to enjoy. What do you think about that kind of model, and what do you think about what's happening with the metro station in Thessaloniki?
When this model was first applied in the Athens metro, it was acclaimed by everybody as an extremely successful example. So I don't see why this should not continue in Thessaloniki, especially given the extreme importance of the finds and their beauty. It's not only the importance, it's something that it is very well preserved, it's very nice, people will enjoy. It's not only for knowing your past, it's also for making your cities better.
Would you say that there's somewhat of an image problem for archaeologists sometimes in Greece? Because often, you know, wrongly, in other cases, maybe rightly, they are seen as the people who cause delays for much needed investment, infrastructure projects.
Recently, there is all this discussion about the old airport area, which you may know as the Hellenic Community, and all these discussions about the archaeologists who delay the project. There are many, many large projects that have taken place in Athens over the past 20 years, including the public works for the Olympic Games, big roads, the Stavros Niarchos Cultural Foundation, which is a huge project, and there was never a problem with that. So the question is whether the problem is the archaeologist or the investor. I ask you to think the difference between an investment like the Stavros Niarchos Foundation, which is a national library, and the opera, and something which is open to the public. And so there was a huge archaeological discovery of extremely important cemetery, and the foundation supported this. And there was an excellent cooperation, and now this is accessible to the public. And there are other investments. I suppose the Hellenicon is one of them, but I don't know very well this subject. Well, there is a private investment that wants to offer exclusivity. And this is a kind of problem in cities like Athens. Antiquities are not only something that relate to the past, it relates also to the present. And I ask you to consider of the ancient agora in Athens, which is actually the biggest park in the city. So there are a lot, you can say, how this site was first made, because a whole neighborhood had to be unrooted from there, but now it is the biggest area of green in a city which has otherwise is full of cement. So this is also a kind of development. This is also something that offers to the quality of life in a city.
What else needs to be done in terms of protecting cultural heritage, and what other examples can you give us?
There are many. First of all, modern history heritage. So all the heritage that, okay, sometimes you see very well preserved and restored Byzantine churches, but there are a lot of settlements. There is the post-Byzantine, the Ottoman period in Greece, which has beautiful monuments that for various reasons have not received the attention. And they are now being more attractive, even to the specialists, because this is not only a problem of policy, of central policy, but all the specialists were not interested in the past. So all these kind of monuments, they offer a potential. There are also places like the one we're here in Southeast Attica in Lavrio, which is an industrial area. So all these, you know, what we call industrial heritage, which is actually the hidden places of the past, the places that sometimes may have unpleasant aspects of the life and human toll and pain and all these kind of things, but still is part of history. So I think there are all these kind of things. And modern, contemporary heritage, I mean, what happens really in city, how people interact with their city. And I think that over the past years, this has been more attractive to a lot of people from abroad as well. Greece is not about its monuments, about its people. And if there are no people to see and interact with the monuments, there are no monuments. People make the monuments. So this is something that even the government, the Ministry of Culture, has to give much more attention and many more funds to modern creation, modern creativity, modern culture.
That was the archaeologist Nikos Papadimitriou speaking to Monocle's Athens correspondent Daphne Karnesis. Now, when it comes to historical preservation, there are few things more important than ensuring sites across each city are properly protected. But how do we also ensure that these important places can be enjoyed by citizens, while also safeguarding them for future generations? Historic England is a state-funded body that's tasked with protecting and saving important sites around the country. Over 400,000 places are listed as important historic environments, from buildings to monuments, gardens to battlefields.
These days, really, that's everything. That's thinking about architecture and buildings, archaeology, landscapes, places, high streets. So my job involves thinking about all those things, really. And also, you know, looking after and supporting colleagues who day to day go out and look at those sites and grapple with their futures and what's significant and interesting about them.
That's Emily Gee, Historic England's Regional Director for London and the South East. She recently caught up with Monocle 24's Tom Edwards here in the studio, and she told Tom about the balancing act required to both promote and protect these important parts of the national story.
These days, heritage in the historic environment is really, really broad. So we're not just talking about castles and country houses that the visiting public will come and see, although, of course, that's a really important part of it and it's a strong tradition in this country. The sites that we look after and help the people who own them and live in them look after are often much more ordinary places and much more active and publicly used places. So we deal with huge sites of infrastructure, of commercial activity, of people's homes, of people's schools. So it's a really broad mixture. And they're not necessarily places that we'd expect people to come and visit, although we do say that the historic environment is kind of open to everyone. And just by walking through, it's the equivalent of going to a museum in many places.
Now, obviously, Emily, our focus is on urbanism. And so perhaps if we look specifically at cities and some of the unique challenges, can you tell us a bit more about the processes, the protections which you mentioned there, how they actually work? Because I imagine a lot of our listeners, wherever they are in the world, and particularly, obviously, if they're here in London, will mainly see discussion around listing processes when there's a controversy. Oh, there's a row, this building is at risk of demolition, or this piece of old infrastructure is not being protected, or it is, and that's prohibiting a new development. Is it a frustration ever that often it is when there's conflicts or disagreements that people tend to take an interest? And actually, you know, these processes are things we should all be much more invested in and maybe knowledgeable about.
Yes, we try and keep it a straightforward and very open process. In the olden days, buildings very heroically were listed for the national good, but they were done quite quickly and without necessarily with consultation with owners. And that's something that we've really worked on with government to improve in the last decade or so, so that we start a conversation from that very earliest point about whether or not a site has special interest. And that's the kind of the main currency, special architectural and historic interest. And when we're assessing sites, we engage really closely with owners, we consult, we want to make sure that we completely understand why a place is significant, or indeed perhaps why it's not at a national level. And our duty is to give advice to government on whether or not a building, you know, sort of meets that high test. Afterwards, it doesn't mean if a building is listed, it's certainly not the end of the story. And we spend a lot of time and energy, quite rightly, thinking about how that site can then be managed and best continued either in its original use or perhaps in a new way. And inevitably, there are a few high profile cases, controversy, and that's often what hits the news. But in many cases, listing is a very happy, constructive conversation about saying, OK, there's something really special here. Let's look after it in a constructive way. And often we can be flexible about change and use and really just keep what's special at the heart of any future use for building. That's the most important thing, really.
And Emily, what's the risk of asking you to generalise where it's not possible to do so? What's the kind of typical origin story? Are your colleagues and experts within Historic England sort of wandering around keeping a weather eye on things? Do architects of buildings themselves suggest to you? Is it the public? Does government say, well, hang on, what about these? How does that shortlisting work? Or is it a completely open process and anyone can sort of chip in and make suggestions?
There's a number of ways. First, it can be a reactive process, and our origins are very much in kind of being responding to threat. That's where the very strong tradition of protection in this country came from, is realising that, gosh, there's something really special here that needs to be looked after. So we are here ready to respond if someone notices that there is a threat to something that might be really important. We all respond to that. We also try to be ahead of the game and think thematically and strategically about where there might be either threat or indeed a need for protection or indeed celebration earlier in ahead of the game. So we have a strategic program within Historic England, and we think ahead of what sort of building types might be undergoing change. We've looked at works of infrastructure, at public buildings, police, fire stations, town halls, that sort of thing over the years. And we also increasingly look by architectural style, thinking about the more recent past. And we did a lot of work on postmodernism a few years ago, just before it became fashionable again, when we knew that there was a sense that actually not everyone was deeply in love with postmodern buildings and they were undergoing a lot of change. And we needed to be ahead of the curve and identify what the most important examples were before they became under threat.
Well, yeah, and I find those examples interesting. And I know, you know, not too far from where we're sat here in Marylebone, there's the Sainsbury's supermarket in Camden Town, which had this protection bestowed to the surprise of some, but to the delight of many. And we've got particular locations that relate to the lives of interesting and prominent people. David Bowie, for example, recently. I mean, you very elegantly described how broad and open and receptive you and your colleagues need to be. But how does one decide that this supermarket is relevant or this little chapter from David Bowie's life is relevant? I mean, what is it, just a movable feast always?
The threshold is pretty high. It's special interest, and it's often quite hard to define. The sort of thing that you would find in a textbook, the sort of thing that you would want to talk about on the radio or tell someone about it, something that's just special, something that has that extra quality of importance to the nation or to architectural movements. So we think, as I say, it's special architectural or historic interest. So when we're thinking about architectural interest, ideally we look at the typology in the round. And the best way often is to think about the national context of a certain building type. Supermarkets, for example, it's highly unlikely that very many purpose-built supermarkets will be listed. But as ever, with the extraordinary nature of kind of architectural endeavour, there will be some that are that bit more special if they're commissioned in a way that is fulfilling a really extraordinary brief and responding, in the case of Sainsbury's that you referred to an existing urban grain, a 19th century environment, a rugged industrial environment, and responding in that case with a really impressive high-tech response by a top firm that was really embracing the new sort of architectural style of high-tech architecture. So that we felt was eminently justifiable as special. It survived well. It exemplified the style. It fit in a really creative way to the urban grain there. In terms of historic interest, we think quite a lot about people. Much of what we've talked about, of course, is buildings, but actually it's people that make buildings and that commission them and that live in them and use them. So we are very alive to the importance of how people interrelate with the historic environment historically. And we want to make sure that the national story on the list also reflects the broad range of people that use and inhabit the historic environment. So we think very carefully about who might have inhabited a building, be that an extraordinary individual or indeed a community that might have a special relationship with a site.
And I guess one thing we're interested in this programme this week is looking at heritage in the city and how extraordinary that is, how it's woven into the urban fabric or the architectural fabric. Do you think that by doing what you and your colleagues do, it's changed almost your sort of understanding of what heritage is for a city, whether it's in terms of that collective experience or shared memory? I guess that's a learning that always continues. But I mean, do you sort of have that almost I don't know, it's a philosophical question almost, I suppose.
We as an organisation, and indeed many public bodies, are thinking a lot more about place at the moment. And I think that's absolutely the right direction that we need to be going in, moving beyond just individually special buildings, although that continues to be really important, and thinking about how they knit together, how they make places that people will enjoy or come together in. And I think as we think about heritage, traditionally, there's a sense that is just referring to really old buildings that sort of sit in blissful isolation. But actually, heritage is the world all around us. And I think we need to be much more encompassing in how we think about that. And place is a really good word for that. It's more encompassing and it helps us to sort of knit together new and old. The King's Cross development comes to mind as a really wonderful example of that. It has very much at its heart that kind of rugged industrial aesthetic of the railway lands and the gasworks that were on the site before, and indeed are really still very visible in that landscape. And they have been used very successfully, I think, as kind of anchors for creating a new type of place, a place where young creative people come together and professionals and families. And I think that is just a really lovely example of how heritage is actually much bigger than individual buildings, but it's a broader place that really can have a wonderful future in cities.
Emily, just finally, I mean, that's pretty much maybe the answer you'd give. Is there one example of a piece of work, an intervention perhaps, or just, as you said, a bit of preemptive, more strategic protection that you and your colleagues have worked on recently that you're particularly proud of or that you think deserves broader, you know, attention from the public at large? Is there one sort of thing? I know it's always tough to sort of choose favourites and it's a bit gimmicky, but is there one thing where you think this is what we're all about and I'm proud of that?
I think probably King's Cross is the example that really comes to mind, where we have buildings that were, you know, formerly used for storing grain, for storing gas, canal basins that have now become fountains where local children come and play, a pocket park now in the guide frame of the gas holder. So that's where I see just a really exciting integration of old and new, bringing a really sort of wonderful place for people to enjoy, but always with that either conscious or unconscious awareness of the past. And for us, that's what's so important about rooting people in places, is just having that reference to the past while also thinking about a really great way to move forward together in an urban environment.
That was Emily G, Historic England's Regional Director for London and the South East. And she was speaking to Monocle's very own Tom Edwards. And finally, on today's episode, we look at a city whose heritage is on display right on its very walls, Lisbon. Here, building facades are covered in tiles, a centuries-old tradition. Monocle's Gaia Lutz paid a visit to the oldest tile factory in the city to find out how it's keeping heritage alive and also with an eye on the future too.
The word Azulejo comes from the Arabic, meaning small polished stone. But no nation has become so well known for the craft as Portugal. You only need to walk around its capital, Lisbon, to understand the huge heritage of the tiles, which adorn several of its buildings, giving life and color to its facades. More than just an aesthetic alternative, the Portuguese style is a reflection of cultural, social, and economic influences, inseparable from the country's history. Founded in Lisbon in 1849, Viúva Lamego was one of the very first tile factories in the country. I headed to Sintra to visit the company's factory, where clay gets turned into porcelain and then into beautiful hand-painted tiles.
My name is Gonçalo Conceição. I'm the owner of Viúva Lamego since 2.5 years. This factory has been founded in 1849, so we're celebrating the 170 year. In fact, I feel like not the owner of the factory, but the, we say in Portugal, the fiel depositário. It means someone that has the obligation and the responsibility to keep this for the next generation. So that's the way I see it. That's the way we work here on a daily basis.
Gonçalo takes me for a tour of the factory floor, the chambers where clay gets dried and cut into squares. Then the glaze gets applied to them. This is a sort of secret sauce of Viúva Lamego that they have been developing for years, which gives their tiles a specific depth and shine, as if they were always wet. Each tile gets checked for internal cracks, a process which involves hitting them one by one with a small metal rod and listening if the sound is whole or fractured. All the while, Gonçalo keeps pointing out some of the factory's ongoing projects. There's a panel commissioned by the city of Prague to celebrate the Velvet Revolution. In another room, I see the famous artist Manuel Carvalheiro. He has been working with the factory since 1949 and is currently painting tiles for a panel which will adorn the Champs-Élysées underground station in Paris.
Ceramic support is very convenient for the divulgation and spread out polycart, because it's a very reliable material and it's very easy to place and replace if necessary. Having said that, we've been working actively all over the world. We have polycart, especially in underground stations. It's the most privileged vehicle that I see from the past, from Santiago de Chile to Moscow. Lisbon, in Stockholm, in Paris, in, I don't know, many cities around the world. It's interesting to see what is happening in the city of Lille, where Marine Aubry, the mayor, is doing a fantastic job of building up history, contemporary history, connected to art within the periphery in order to connect the center and the periphery of the city. And she's doing a very impressive work. And we are working with cities like Prague, Lisbon, of course, because the proximity helps a lot, Paris, Marseille, Lille, and recently with São Paulo in Brazil and Dakar in Senegal. I have been discussing this with the public authorities. It's a long journey until we reach some results, but we keep saying that public art is one of the best vehicles for people to feel integrated within the city, independently where they live.
We head upstairs to the painting studios, where ladies, some working here for over 40 years, apply paint, sometimes in modernist strokes, sometimes with a floral embellishment, tile by tile. In the archive section, we see piled tiles, some from the 1800s and others worked on by internationally renowned names, such as Yayoi Kusama, Álvaro Siza, Rem Koolhaas, Paula Rego, and so many more. But while Viúva Lamego seems to have no problem in terms of the product it offers, it has come across some other challenges. Gonçalo Conceição told me about how cheap industrial tiles are threats to the business, and how he aims at communicating that a Viúva Lamego tile is more than just a tile. It's a piece of history and heritage that will live on in the city.
The cost of construction have rose abruptly in the last few years. The real estate price also have rose abruptly. And people tend to save money at the end of the project. And the facade is one of the last things that a building sees in terms of construction. So it's easier with the technology available in the market to produce similar products within 24 hours, 48 hours, on a production line, you know, that has debit capacity 10 times higher than, or 100 times higher than the one we have here. So I say to my customers, if you want to have Vivolameg, you need time. It's not a matter of money, it's a matter of time. Time is money, of course. But we've been dealing with cheap competition, industrial driven, and what we're selling is a completely different product. It's something with the heritage, because we apply every day the old techniques that we have in the factory. You had a chance to see what Cargalero said regarding specific techniques that we can do here, and any factory in France was able to do for his project at Champs-Élysées underground. And that's part of the heritage itself. So you can have the best. Sometimes two white shirts are similar if you look at very quickly, but if you put it on, it feels different. And that's what we try to sell. Something that on a day-to-day basis, people feels different.
From Monaco in Viuva Lamego's factory in Lisbon, I'm Gaia Lutz.
It's clear that the desire to progress while defending the past can lead to tensions in cities. But as we wipe away that past, we also wipe away the chance to connect with the lives of the people who called this city home before us. And by doing so, we also make our role in the life of the city seem more fleeting. So while we shouldn't slam on the brakes, we should drive with caution. Heritage is not the past, it's a path that leads to the future. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and it was edited by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Groove Armada with History. Thank you for listening, city lovers.